Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about Affordable Care Act open enrollment, a Crow singer who was nominated for a Native American Music Award, and an update on the vaping ban hearing. It's Friday, November 1st. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. Montana's Democratic Senator John Tester said in a press call yesterday, new federal regulations for hemp could create more certainty for farmers and boost job growth in the state. Rachel Kramer reports.
The USDA regulations are intended to create national standards for hemp production and eliminate legal uncertainty, which will help farmers access loans and crop insurance. Senator Tester says it's a step in the right direction.
It's a good start. I think we've got to continue to look and listen to the folks who are growing and utilizing it in manufacturing and tweak it as necessary.
Some of the new rules in the 161-page draft include licensing requirements for farmers. Others require hemp to be tested in labs registered with the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency. Plants with too much THC, the chemical compound that can get you high, would be destroyed. Industrial hemp became legal to grow beyond state research and pilot projects with the 2018 Farm Bill. Since then, the non-psychoactive CBD oil derived from hemp has become part of a multi-billion dollar industry. Montana farmers facing low wheat and pulse crop prices planted around 22,000 acres of hemp last year, and almost double that in 2019. But it's still a bit of a risky business. There aren't any big processors in the state to turn raw, harvested hemp into CBD oil, t-shirts, or biofuels. A group of farmers recently filed a lawsuit alleging out-of-state companies haven't paid them what they're owed. Tester says this isn't unprecedented for pioneering industries.
I mean, I got into organics 35 years ago. It was the same kind of deal where you had a lot of companies that were operating on a shoestring budget and sometimes you didn't get paid. As that industry matured, of course, businesses get much more financially secure and that's less of a risk.
Tester and Republican Senator Steve Daines have both supported funding and policies to strengthen the hemp industry in Montana. A 60-day public comment period on the USDA's new regulations will end December 30th. The agency will use this feedback when drafting its final set of rules in 2 years. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Next year, premiums for individual health insurance plans in Montana will go down for the first time since the Affordable Care Act took effect. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney reports open enrollment starts today.
The roughly 50,000 Montanans who receive health coverage in the Affordable Care Act marketplace could see their premium bills drop by hundreds or thousands of dollars next year. John Doran is a vice president for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana.
For the first time since the inception of the ACA back in 2014, all three insurance companies offering plans to Montanans are seeing a drop in premiums over the previous year.
Blue Cross Blue Shield, Pacific Source, and the Montana Health Co-op are the three providers of health insurance on the individual market in the state. At the direction of a state law passed earlier this year, the companies are pooling their money together to help cover high-ticket claims for health care. The federal government is also adding money to the pool and paying for a majority of the costs. The result is that insurers don't have to gamble on paying large and unpredictable health care bills because the new policy builds what amounts to insurance for insurance companies, and this lowers premium costs. Doran says there are other factors contributing to the decline in premium costs in 2020, like insurance companies seeing more stability within the Affordable Care Act. But he says the recent pooling of insurance companies and federal dollars is a big part of it. Richard Miltenberger is the president of the Montana Health Co-op, the largest provider on the individual market in the state.
The average person's rate's going to go down 5 to 7%.
That's just the average for the co-op. What Montanans on the individual market actually see on their premium bills could be much higher or lower than that. While costs are going down next year, Miltenberger says the recent changes to how insurance companies approach expensive health claims isn't a permanent fix to rising health care costs across the country.
In a way, we've had a slow-motion train wreck for the last 20 years in health care costs. It's slowing down a little bit more this year, but we need some significant cost relief in healthcare.
The premium cost reductions expected in 2020 doesn't apply to people receiving health coverage from their employer. The price for individual market plans depend on a person's age, location, and income. Matt Rosendale, the state auditor and commissioner of securities and insurance, says every insurance plan sold in Montana's individual marketplace will cost less in the coming year.
Across the board, we're looking at saving $51 million to the ratepayers here in Montana for the 2020 year.
Open enrollment on healthcare.gov runs from November 1st through December 15th. I'm Corin Cates-Carney, Montana Public Radio News.
Federal officials yesterday revealed more specifics about the timeline and process surrounding the final deal for Butte's Superfund cleanup, although some details are still murky. Montana Public Radio's Nora Sachs reports.
In mid-October, the parties in charge of the cleanup announced they had reached agreement on a final, legally binding deal, marking a turning point in the mining city's three-decades-long Superfund saga. The cleanup deal still has to be reviewed and signed by senior officials at the state of Montana, Atlantic Richfield Company, the U.S. Department of Justice, and EPA. In a statement released Thursday, EPA said, quote, "We estimate that process will take from 4 to 5 weeks, but it could be shorter or longer," unquote. Once those parties have signed off on the deal, the entire package will be made available to the public and Butte's Council of Commissioners, who have to vote on whether or not to sign it. According to EPA, Butte Silver Bow County plans to hold public education meetings to answer questions about the proposal and will likely accept informal public comment as part of their deliberation process. The county will release more details soon. If the consent decree is approved by all of the Superfund parties, it will then be lodged with a federal court and eventually released for a formal 30-day public comment period. If the consent decree is not entered, the EPA has legal authority to issue a unilateral order and force Atlantic Richfield and Butte Silver Bow to perform the final cleanup work. I'm Nora Sachs, Montana Public Radio.
The Montana Supreme Court heard oral arguments Wednesday about whether BNSF Railway can be held liable for exposing Libby residents to asbestos that was in shipments of vermiculite it transported before the local mine shut down in 1990. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports.
The court heard a little over an hour of oral arguments from BNSF and a Kalispell-based law firm, which is representing the 1,200 plaintiffs in the case. Those plaintiffs say they were exposed to harmful asbestos dust in Libby that came from vermiculite BNSF was carrying as freight. Attorney Jennifer Merriman says back in January, the Asbestos Claims Court, charged with hearing Libby-related asbestos cases, ruled in favor of her clients in several key areas.
The first being finding that BNSF was strictly liable for its operations in Libby, Montana, involving vermiculite. And the second issue was whether or not federal law would preempt plaintiffs' claims or basically bar plaintiffs' claims. And the third issue was whether or not BNSF, as a common carrier charged with transporting freight, should be immune from strict liability.
The asbestos court found that overall, BNSF could not shield itself from liability with the argument that it was merely transporting products it was paid to carry. It's not clear when Montana Supreme Court will issue a ruling on the appeal. If it signs with the plaintiffs in the case, it could then move to trial. Calls to BNSF and the attorney representing the company were not returned in time for this story. This is the second Libby asbestos appeal the state's highest court has heard since the inception of the Asbestos Claims Court. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
Montana State University Billings and Northwest College in Powell, Wyoming are 90 miles apart, but the two institutions are working to shorten that distance academically. Kay Erickson reports.
The two schools have done collaborations in the past, but the schools see a renewed opportunity.
Northwest reached out to us because of our reputation and our student-focused abilities here.
That's MSUB Chancellor Dan Edelman. He and a group of administrators made a field trip to Powell last week to meet face-to-face with their counterparts and explore how the two schools can better serve their students. One of the strong draws for Northwest College is MSUB's far-reaching online presence. But the collaboration is not just one way, says Northwest College President Stephanie Hickswa.
There's some things that we can do to shore up some of the gaps in the curriculum at MSUB.
An example is engineering, with more courses at the two-year college in Powell than in Billings. The meeting between the administrative teams was very preliminary, more of a get-to-know-you event, but both administrators are excited about the education opportunities for their students.
You know, you get a bunch of smart people in the room, and it's way bigger than what Chancellor Edelman and I ever could have come up with ourselves.
MSUB is the closest four-year institution to Powell and other nearby communities in the Bighorn Basin. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Kay Erickson.
A Crow singer might take home her second National Music Award this weekend. As Olivia Rheingold reports, Desha Eagletail is nominated for Best Female Artist and Best Country Artist in this year's Native American Music Awards. Desha Eagletail is rushing to the airport.
Okay, let me put my seatbelt on.
She's got an hour before her flight takes off and her seven-hour journey to Niagara Falls, New York begins. That's where the sold-out award ceremony will take place this Saturday. The song Eagletail is nominated for in Best Country and Best Female Artist is called What Do I Got to Do? She says she wrote it as a music student at MSUB when the hour-long commute between the Crow Reservation and campus left her feeling lonely.
It was just like kind of me asking the universe, kind of like, what do I gotta do? And to have someone to love.
Eagle Feather is one of about four nominees for Montana Tribes this year, including Jared Stewart from the Crow Tribe and Joseph Fire Crow from the Northern Cheyenne Tribe. The 19th Annual Native American Music Awards, or NAMIs, will present Indigenous artists awards across more than 30 categories, including rock, come on, fly with me, powwow drumming, and traditional recording. That was nominees Irv Lyons Jr., Those Women's, and Herman Cody in that order. For a decade, the Grammy Awards presented a Best Native American Music Album Award, but got rid of it almost 10 years ago, along with 30 other categories, including Best Zydeco Album and Best Hawaiian Music. Now, Native music is judged in the streamlined category Best Roots Performance. Eagletail says she's proud to participate in an awards show that's by Indigenous people for Indigenous people.
I am really happy to be acknowledged and validated by other Native Americans.
If she wins, this would be her second time taking home a NAMI.
Good evening and welcome, everyone.
Last year, she won for Best Country Musician. She was pregnant with her now 10-month-old son and says she was shocked when her name came up on the screen. For this year's event, Eagletail says she plans to wear a dress by Crow designer Della Big Hair Stump. The Native American Music Awards will stream live this Saturday on YouTube at 5 p.m. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Olivia Rheingold. I'd like to marry, but it's going slow. And then there's you and you're a no-show. Where the hell are you? Olivia Rheingold is Yellowstone Public Radio's Report for America Corps member. Responses to a survey released yesterday show strong support for increasing taxes in Montana to fund conservation projects. At the same time, respondents said they want out-of-staters to pay more. Nikki Ouellette reports.
The survey comes from the Montana Outdoor Heritage Project, a coalition of odd bedfellows advocating for more public funding for recreational and working lands in Montana. The project's members include the Montana Snowmobile Association, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, the Nature Conservancy, Blue Cross Blue Shield, private businesses, and a range of advocacy groups. Together, they spent the past year polling 11,000 Montanans on what they value about the state's public lands and outdoor recreation and how to fund conservation.
83% of the people who responded to our survey said they would support more dedicated funding for the great outdoors, and even if that means increasing some state taxes.
Dave Chadwick is the executive director of the Montana Wildlife Federation and a project ambassador. He says while a majority of respondents supported more public funding to secure access to public lands, preserve water quality, and protect areas to fish and hunt, Montanans also want tourists to pay more, too.
You know, we know that people come from all over the world to visit Montana and to enjoy our outdoors. And Some of us are lucky enough to live here year-round, but we shouldn't be the ones who are expected to carry the whole burden of conserving our outdoors and protecting access.
The new report suggests state policy changes, like expanding current sales tax options for gateway communities and setting higher fees for out-of-state second homeowners. It also shows hunters and anglers' desires for more user groups to share the cost of conservation. The report suggests a sales tax on outdoor recreation gear, similar to federal excise taxes on hunting and fishing gear, and creating new user fees for other types of outdoor activities. Ambassadors for the Outdoor Heritage Project say state lawmakers made strides in recent years by passing bills that increased light motor vehicle registration fees to fund grants for trails, state parks, and fishing access site maintenance. Recent legislation also restored funding to Habitat Montana, a state conservation program. Project ambassador and rancher Cole Mannix says the coalition's next step is talking to lawmakers about other policy changes that could raise money for public land use and conservation.
What we have is not an accident, and it has taken resources in the past to get us to where we are now, but it will also take increased funding in the future. There was a lot of agreement on that.
The full report is on our website, ypradio.org. I'm Nikki Ouellette for Yellowstone Public Radio News.
The Bullock administration appeared in state district court in Hamilton Wednesday to defend its order to temporarily halt the sale of flavored e-cigarettes in the state. A Montana Vaping Industry Association is challenging that order, and a state judge allowed the continued sale of flavored vaping products until a final ruling is made. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney spoke with Edward O'Brien about the Wednesday hearing.
Hi, Edward.
Hey, Corin.
Tell us what happened at the courthouse.
Well, it was quite the marathon session. Some of us in the press corps who attended today's hearing expected an hour to maybe three. It ended up being a marathon session running almost 8 hours with over 10 witnesses and just as many, if not more, attorneys.
And just a reminder for listeners, this is all about Governor Steve Bullock's 120-day ban on flavored vaping products he announced earlier this month. At the time of the order, the Bullock administration said it was responding to what it called a rapidly developing public health crisis. Edward, how's the administration defending this ban in court?
Well, boiled down, they say the attorneys representing the state said that proposed emergency ban on flavored e-cigs was meant to basically reduce the appeal of vaping to kids. They say the flavoring is really designed to increase the frequency of vaping and to eventually, long-term, attract more customers. They point to the almost 1,500 cases nationally of pulmonary illness and over 30 fatalities, including one here in Montana. And again, they're saying these e-cigs and vaping devices are creating a new generation of nicotine-addicted kids.
We've heard from state doctors on this so far, but during the court hearing, did they bring any new compelling witnesses for their case?
Yeah, there were several compelling witnesses on both sides of this. For the state side, one I found particularly interesting, Dr. Lauren Wilson. She's a Missoula pediatrician, holds a leadership position in the Montana chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And she pointed out vaping has loads of volatile organic compounds and silicates. And she says that the long-term risks may be slightly lower than straight-up tobacco products like cigarettes, but we just don't know yet, she said. Dr. Wilson says she and her colleagues suspect that these kids will later graduate to cigarettes. She says that those colleagues are asking now 9- and 10-year-olds if they're vaping. They want to find out who's doing it, and they're frustrated by this. The state also brought forward a school resource officer from Missoula and a school administrator from the Bitterroot who say they're confiscating more e-cig and vape products over the past couple of years. The school resource officer says a ban on flavors would help make vaping less alluring. Also, finally, there was a Bitterroot mom, Mindy Hogan, who said she has two kids, and she says she's been blindsided by the prevalence of this vape and e-cig trends. She's finding out more about it through interaction with her kids. She has lots of experience in social work and hospital care and says this whole thing is mortifying to her, and she wants to find out more.
We heard from the Vaping Association leading up to this that Bullock's ban could really hurt their businesses, cause them to lay off workers. Now that they're in the courtroom, who are they bringing up as witnesses to argue their case?
There were the four vape store owners and the president of a trade association representing the group, all Montanans, who, as you said, say this will just devastate their businesses and employees and not really do anything to help the public health crisis. They maintain that it's THC and black market products that are making so many people ill. One of the most interesting exchanges, I thought, involved a witness presented by the plaintiffs themselves, who, of all things, described himself as an anti-tobacco warrior, Dr. Michael Siegel. He's a professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. And Dr. Siegel pointed out that the vast majority of vaping-related pulmonary illnesses and deaths, as reported by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, involved young men who were vaping THC and those black market cartridges. He says it's no coincidence that the mortality spike is a relatively new phenomenon, and he chalks it up again to the THC vaping and the use of a form of vitamin E that's used as a thickening agent. Again, the state argues their temporary ban is focused on those flavored e-cig products because it's drawing in kids, that kids find that attractive. Dr. Siegel counters that the flavoring really isn't the main issue. It's the high nicotine levels that he's most concerned about in these products. He argued that the ban on these flavored products will exacerbate the youth tobacco problem, pushing more people, adults and kids, to traditional cigarettes. As I mentioned, vape store owners testified. All were plaintiffs in this case. One of them, Lucas Anderson, is owner of Ublaze Vapor and president of the Montana Smoke-Free Association, that trade group. He says his business would be destroyed by the ban. While he disliked the candy packaging, he says it's not a problem in his store since he's never sold to young people, something that all of the vape store owners were boasting about. Furthermore, Anderson described the temporary ban as a knee-jerk reaction, and that DPHHS, the state health department, never stepped forward to offer legislation, to come up with legislation to restrict access to young people.
And do we know when the judge is going to make a ruling?
Well, we do. The state, there were so many witnesses, the judge ran out of time in her courtroom. The state still has a couple of more witnesses to present. They'll bring them forward Friday at noon, and we think we should have an answer to this case then.
Edward O'Brien joins us from the State District Court in Hamilton. Edward, thanks for sharing your reporting.
Thanks, Gordon.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds Monday morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.